Illinois Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth have announced tens of millions of dollars in federal funding for programs across the state that provide early childhood education, health, and social services to low-income families.
This is a program that is a blessing and a benefit for not only for the children, but also for the families.
We discuss the importance of Head Start programs, in particular for rural communities. Plus, when it comes to romance, what does science have to say about what makes a relationship strong?
Fewer people are marrying, and those who marry are at greater risk for divorce. But those marriages who get it right are fulfilling in a way that would have been out of reach in an era where people weren't even trying to achieve those sorts of things.
We get tips for building the kind of relationship that will stand the test of time. But first, PolitiFact Illinois' Matt Dietrich joins us to talk about why the state budget might already be out of balance. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer in for Nyla Boodoo. In July, the Illinois General Assembly overrode a veto by Governor Bruce Rauner to pass the state's first budget in more than 2 years. But as PolitiFact Illinois reports, making that plan work presents its own challenges. And a few weeks ago, Governor Rauner claimed that the budget is actually out of balance by $1 billion. Matt Dietrich is a reporter with PolitiFact Illinois and the Better Government Association. He wrote about the governor's claim and about some of the possible problems with the budget. Matt, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be here. Thanks, Yvonne.
You've been on the show many times during this budget crisis, and we appreciate your willingness to help us sort of number crunch. But this summer, the State House finally agreed on a budget. And on paper, it looks like that budget actually produces a surplus of $360 million. That according to the Civic Federation, which is a Chicago-based fiscal watchdog group. But as the Federation said, it's a spending and revenue plan. So the money the budget's supposed to be bringing in or spending may or may not actually happen. And two of the big things that are up for question are a pension plan and the sale of the Thompson Center. Could you break down what's happening in those two areas, please? Can we start with pensions?
Sure. With pensions, the governor said that $500 million of the $1 billion imbalance that he identified comes because a new pension plan referred to as Tier 3, it's kind of like a 401k savings plan that's public employees are eligible for. He says that the budget overestimates what that's going to save by $500 million. In fact, the budget says that the state will save $500 million in FY18 from this new plan, but we spoke to the head of the teachers' retirement system, one of the biggest state retirement systems, who said that they don't even plan to implement this thing until July 1st, 2019. So Illinois is not going to see any savings from that until fiscal year 2020. So right there, you have $500 million that's been written into the budget as savings that this is not going to materialize this year, and we know that now. So now here's the tricky part. That $500 million savings estimate came directly from the governor's original budget that he himself put out back in February. And this Tier 3 pension plan was the governor's idea. It was something that he had really pushed for. So what the budgeteers did on the budget that eventually passed, what they did, they simply took his savings number from his original budget and stuck it into their budget and used it. But as it turns out, you know, that might make the governor inconsistent, but he's not wrong. So they're going to have to figure out a way to come up with another $500 million now to make this thing balance. Now, they didn't know that at the time that they passed the budget on July 6th. So at that time, and for that snapshot of that budget, it was balanced. It was only afterwards that the news came up that, you know, we're not going to see this savings until long after this fiscal year.
So how do we go from being able to say, yes, we're going to save this $500 million right off the bat, and then push it back to 2019 or possibly 2020?
Well, what's going to have to happen is we had the same problem actually about 2 years ago. In March of 2015, the state had a budget that was on pace to be $1.6 billion out of balance. And that's because when the Democratic-led General Assembly and the Democratic governor, who was Pat Quinn, back in May of 2014, when they designed their budget for fiscal year 2015, they were designing it assuming that the 5% income tax rate that was in effect at the time, that it would continue into perpetuity. But what happened was halfway through that fiscal year, Bruce Rauner was elected, and the income tax increase was not extended. It fell, and therefore the state found itself $1.6 billion short because income taxes fell by 25%. So the Governor Rauner and the General Assembly, the lawmakers, they came together in March 2015, and they found a way to move some funds around. They made some cuts. They closed that $1.6 billion hole. That's what you're going to have to see at some point in fiscal year 2018. And one thing that's important to remember is that, you know, for the past 2 years, we had no budget. So our bills didn't get paid. There was nothing to control spending. It was out of control. That's how we built up this massive $16 billion bill backlog. The one positive about all this is that now there's a budget in place. So now when the governor and the lawmakers get together to try to fix this, they actually have something to work on. Okay, so there is a framework in place. They're just
uncommon that framework would be out of balance.
No. During the course of a budget year, you always have things that are changing slightly. For example, income tax revenue might come in much higher than expected or lower than expected. They try to avoid that. They're pretty good on making projections, but sometimes these things happen. Or you have emergencies and things have to be changed at the last minute. It's not uncommon. It's a little different. We always get this talk from politicians about how your government budget is the same as your household budget, and you need to that it both work the same way. It's not really that way. Your household budget really is kind of a fixed thing, and you can predict what your expenses are going to be. You know what your income's going to be. State budget's different. State budget's more of a lot of moving parts within it.
So as we're talking about that revenue side, one of the projects in the works is the sale of the Thompson Center that Illinois has been exploring since 2015. What is its status?
Well, its status is that it's been hung up. It's in about the same place that it was when Governor Rauner first announced it almost 2 years ago. And what's happened with the Thompson Center is it got caught right in the middle of a huge fight between the governor on one side, Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, and House Speaker Michael Madigan on the other side. Primarily, this has been a battle between Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Rauner over the Thompson Center. So the bottom line is the sale has gone nowhere, and the problem for the budget is that it relies on, as you mentioned at the beginning there, on paper it had a $360 million surplus. And $240 million of that surplus comes from the sale of the Thompson Center. So this budget assumes that sometime between now and next July 1st, the Thompson Center in the Chicago Loop is going to be sold for somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million. That's kind of a big assumption. Now, from a market standpoint, there's no reason to doubt that the Thompson Center wouldn't fetch the price that they're trying to get for it. It's a prime location right in the middle of the very thriving Chicago Loop where there's all kinds of construction going on now.
But if I recall correctly, wasn't there some talk about the CTA location that's housed there?
Right.
And who would go about replacing that if the new owners decided they didn't want it to be there?
Sure. There's lots of details that need to be worked out. That's got to be worked out on the city end. And this is where Rahm Emanuel can give some pushback to Governor Rauner, because there were, as this budget standoff, you know, they were fighting over funding for Chicago schools. You might recall that when the school funding bill was the big controversy throughout the summer, that was how much money Chicago Public Schools was going to get was the big thing that was fueling that. That is all Rahm Emanuel versus Bruce Rauner. So Emanuel could use the Thompson Center sale. You know, Governor, if you want me to move on this, let's see what you can do to help CPS here. So it was caught in that kind of a tug of war. And, you know, what you hear so often from people who have seen big deals happen in state government over the years, what you hear them saying is, you know, if they really wanted to get the Thompson Center sold, if this was George Ryan or Jim Edgar or Jim Thompson, and they were working with Mike Madigan and Mayor Daley to get the Thompson Center sold, they would have had it done by now. They would have come together, regardless of parties. They would have said, look, Mayor, we need you to do this. Here's what we got. You know, that's how you deal in government. This really was just a collision between Rauner and Emanuel, and to an extent, Speaker Madigan, although Speaker Madigan has advanced some legislation and done some work in Springfield that has ostensibly been to sort of grease the wheels getting the Thompson Center deal going. But right now it's pretty well stalled, and you're not hearing a whole lot about it.
Got it.
It
so we're not going
to happen, but sure, go ahead.
We're not going to get the $500 million, at least right off the bat, from any state workers putting benefits in that 401k savings plan. We're not going to get any money, at least not that we can conceivably see in the near future, from the Thompson Center. So in addition to that, we still have about $16 billion worth of debt to pay on top of funding basic government services. How much of that can the state realistically pay off during this fiscal year?
Well, if one of the things that was part of the budget was a provision that allows the governor's office to issue up to $6 billion in bonds to pay down a lot of that bill backlog. The problem with the bill backlog, in addition to the fact that it's $16 billion, the problem with it is you've got about $5.5 billion of it, which is accruing late penalties of 9 to 12%. Now, by selling bonds, by issuing bonds, you can pay it off quickly at interest rates of, they've talked about 4.5 to 6%. Anyway, you'd cut your interest in half. It's like refinancing your home. To do that, you do need some money to finance it, and that's where you get back into this very narrow surplus, that $360 million that we have to sell the Thompson Center to get to, and some other things have to happen. So all of this is extremely, extremely fragile. And the governor just last week announced that he went out for, I think, $4.5 billion in bonds to get this bill backlog paid down. Good news about that is if you pay down $3 billion worth of Medicaid expenses, mm-hmm. and I believe there are more than $4 billion in Medicaid expenses sitting in that bill backlog, you get matching from the federal government. So the state could pay down $3 billion of its Medicaid bills, then it gets $3 billion back from the federal government in matching, then it can continue to pay down some of the
rest
of that.
That's $16 billion, right.
Yes, but Yvonne, as you said, this is all so fragile. And, you know, the Thompson Center sale, if it doesn't go through, where are you going to come up with that $240 million? You got $500 million that you know is missing from pensions right now. We're not really sure. I'm not sure if are there special funds within the budget that they could go to, as they did in 2015, and move some money around to make it work through the year. That's a possibility.
If you look into your magic crystal ball then and try to predict how this is going to affect things in Springfield as we go forward, can we expect even more gridlock?
I think that one thing that will help for Illinois is that 2018 is an election year, and no one, not the governor, not any of the legislative leaders, want to see elections during a time of horrible gridlock like we had the past 2 years. That's going to be an incentive for them to work together to make this budget work, and also don't forget that they're going to have to do another budget next May for fiscal year 2019, which will be, you know, that'll start at the height of the 2018 election season. I think that's going to be a big incentive for them this spring to actually get down to work, make this budget, fix it, repair it just the way they did. You know, they've done this before. They did it 2 years ago. You've got to assume they can do it again this time, and they'll be motivated to. So that's where I think if there's anything positive to be drawn from this, it's the fact that, number one, there is a budget in place. It just needs to be fixed. It's not like the last 2 years where there was no budget and no talks going on. And number two, all of these folks know that they are really going to be in hot water on the campaign trail if they're out there, no matter what your party, no matter what you've supported or voted against. If you're out there and the state is back into utter chaotic dysfunction, you're not going to have success on the campaign trail. You're going to have a hard time of it. So I think that's, you know, if there's something positive to be gleaned here, that's where it comes from.
Well, we will wait and see how this plays out during election season. Matt Dietrich, a reporter with PolitiFact Illinois and the Better Government Association, thanks so much for your insights and for being with us here on the 21st.
Thank you, Yvonne.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting World on the Horizon, Swahili Arts Across the Indian Ocean, the first U.S. traveling exhibition dedicated to the arts of the Swahili Coast and their enduring connections around the world. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo today. When it comes to romance, what does it take to have the kind of relationship that will stand the test of time? And what does science have to say about what makes a relationship strong? I'm joined on the line now by two relationship experts who are here to help us understand what works and what doesn't work to keep the fire burning strong with your spouse or partner. Brian Ogalski is an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Illinois and the author of a recent study published in the Journal of Family Theory and Review. And Eli Finkel is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University and author of a new book, The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. Brian, Eli, welcome to the 21st, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Eli, I'll start with you. You're a psychologist that studied thousands of married couples. What are some of the most common reasons that people express satisfaction in their marriage? We'll start with the good stuff.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are incredibly valuable. People who are satisfied with their sex life tend to be extremely happy in their marriage. People who tend to feel like their partner helps them grow to become a better version of themselves are happy with their lives in general. In general, the satisfaction with our closest romantic relationship is one of the most important things toward predicting a happy life in general.
So with that in mind, if someone is not experiencing a happy sex life, they don't feel like their partner's helping them grow to be better, are there strategies that they can employ to help improve those areas?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ideas that I introduced in this book, The All or Nothing Marriage, is that it's really about supply and demand. So there's the demands that we're placing on the marriage or in the relationship, that is what we're asking of it. And then there's also the supply. What is it that realistically the marriage or the relationship can supply for us? That is like compatibility and time together and emotional connection. And so there are three general strategies we can adopt. One is that we invest more to make sure that we're meeting the demands that we're placing on the marriage. One is to ask less, That is to bring the demands in alignment with what's realistic. And then a third option is to try to be a little bit more efficient with the time and energy that we have together. That's not going to make the marriage spectacular, but can certainly improve things around the edges.
So let's break that down just a little bit. If I'm going to invest more, does that mean investing more into what my partner is trying to accomplish as an individual, or invest more into who we are as a married couple?
You know, all of the above, but more the second thing that you listed. You know, one of the things that's exciting about attending closely to developments within relationship science is that, you know, we've had platitudes for quite a while about the ways to improve the marriage, you know, have better communication, go on date nights. We're getting to the point where we can be much more specific about these things. So, for example, yes, date nights tend to be good for your marriage, but in particular, if you're trying to, say, get some of the spark back, there are specific things you can do on date nights, and some things, like engaging in new and outside-the-box sorts of activities, tend to be especially beneficial in terms of making us feel more passion in the relationship, whereas other things, sure, can make us feel connected, but are less beneficial in terms of promoting passion, for example.
And in terms of asking less, does that mean that I should just kind of keep my mouth shut sometimes about the things that I need as an individual?
No, I really don't think so. I mean, I think it's important to be tuned in to what we really value, the things that are especially important to us. And I think we should speak loudly, respectfully, but loudly about what those things are. But we've built a marriage today, right? The way most of us think about marriage is that this one relationship is supposed to provide us what historically was provided by a village. And so, you know, do we need to rely on this one person to be the source of emotional fulfillment, psychological fulfillment across in so many different ways? And so I think there are ways that we can actually leverage our broader social network, our siblings, other family members, friends, who can be sources of support, especially in places where our partner really isn't especially skilled at providing support for us.
And be more efficient means what?
We often will look to this one person to be the person we look to when we're sad at work and want to think it through, when we're feeling excited about something and want to celebrate. And the reality is that when you break down that long list of things that you're looking for your partner to do, some of them will play to his or her strengths, but others won't, right? And so to the degree that we can really try to focus on the strengths that my partner and I have, then we tend to be able to enjoy things relatively efficiently. To the degree that we're trying to turn our partner into somebody that really isn't who he or she really is, when we could turn to a friend who actually really likes, say, talking about office politics or something like that, we can actually live a life that's more fulfilling at the personal level and also build a relationship that's more satisfying in general.
Brian, thank you for your patience. What have you learned in your research? I know you study relationships in general. Are there differences between the way couples who are not married handle their relationships and the way couples who are married handle their relationships?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And much of what Eli just said applies across the board. I mean, he knows as much about relationships across the board as anybody. And what we find in our relationship maintenance review is really applicable broadly to dating couples, to married couples, and other kinds of relationships. Certainly, there are things that affect couples differently at different phases of their relationships. But in general, what we were looking at was kind of cataloging the myriad things that couples do across different times in response to different things that are emerging.
So for example?
So our broad classification, what we're interested in is trying to look at all of the many different maintenance strategies that people use. How can we think about them in a broader way? And so we sort of categorize them as either having a threat mitigation kind of motivation or a relationship enhancement motivation. And sort of put into lay terms, if we think about threats, on a given day, different things come from our broader social environment, even from within the relationship, that might threaten our satisfaction level, our commitment level, our interest in our partner. And those are the kinds of things that we have to stave off to keep feeling satisfied, to keep feeling happy, and keep our relationship going. The relationship enhancement strategies are things that we try to employ as kind of, you know, keeping the spark going, as Eli spoke about it, but not necessarily in response to a direct threat.
So do you find that couples, will tend to use more relationship enhancement strategies or more threat reducing strategies over the course of their relationship? Do couples tend to gravitate to one area over another?
No, we really don't see that. This is kind of a broad array of different strategies that folks use. All relationships are going to encounter certain threats at certain times. Now, certainly daters experience, threats from the outside, alternative partners, potentially, cheating kinds of behaviors, maybe with a slightly higher frequency than more established couples. But they also need to do things. They need to put the goods into their relationship to keep it moving along. So these are both critical, depending on the situation that these couples are in, what phase of development they're in. They're just going to see different sorts of things, and their needs are likely to change over time. But the whole repertoire needs to be there in order to keep the engine moving.
Eli, in your book about marriage, you write about how the American ideal of marriage has evolved over time, and that now we expect our spouses to make us feel loved and valued, and at the same time help us sort of on our journey of self-actualization. Is there a problem with that?
Yes and no. It turns out that these changes, where we look to the marriage to do such a broad range of different things for us when it comes to our emotional and psychological needs, that this is both a good thing or a bad thing, or maybe a better way to say it, it can either be a good thing or a bad thing as a function of whether the relationship can actually help us achieve those things. So the thing about expectations is when they go up, they get harder to achieve. And so a lot of people have recommended that we shouldn't expect so much from our marriages, and I think that's a reasonable piece of advice. The problem is, I don't think you can ask that question in isolation. Are expectations too high or too low? Really isn't the question. The question is, are your expectations appropriate in light of what the marriage can realistically provide? And it turns out that as we've shifted our expectations to these deeper emotional and psychological sorts of need fulfillment, including things like helping me live an authentic life, helping me grow toward my ideal self, more marriages are, in fact, falling short. A marriage that would have been fully sufficient in 1950 is disappointing for us today. But at the same time, those marriages that are able to fulfill those lofty expectations are more fulfilling than ever, because in the past, people weren't even trying to fulfill those things. And these days, marriages that successfully fulfill them are the best marriages that we've ever seen.
So we've come a long way then from those marriages that were designed to help, let's say, increase the family value or expand the financial coffers or land acquisition from way back when marriages were almost arranged because of the benefits mutually agreeable for both of the families. If we look back If we look back then to now, do we find more or less satisfaction or more or less longevity in a marriage because we've involved so many emotions?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly how things have changed. And in fact, you know, it's certainly the case that marriage still has economic components and things like that. But people used to look to their marriage literally for things like food, clothing, and shelter. I mean, before industrialization, the ability to work effectively together was sometimes a life and death situation. And so people didn't primarily look to their spouse for personal fulfillment. They preferred to love their spouse, of course, but that wasn't really the purpose of marriage. Marriages lasted longer then. Let me say it this way. People died younger, but very few people divorced back then. It was heavily socially sanctioned. You weren't supposed to divorce. And frankly, living life as a single person wasn't really an option anyway. So what's happened is, through industrialization, and now we're in the post-industrial world, we have greater freedom. We can make a life by ourselves. And marriage has become increasingly optional. And in doing so has become increasingly fragile, right? Fewer people are marrying, and those who marry are at greater risk for divorce. But those marriages who get it right are fulfilling in a way that would have been out of reach in an era where people weren't even trying to achieve those sorts of things.
Got it. So, Brian, can you give us some practical steps or advice for couples so that they can move out of this, we're always constantly putting out small fires, and move more into that zone of thriving and growing together as a couple?
Well, you know, The truth of the matter is, I sort of don't view it as an either or proposition. If you build on this idea that we're asking a lot of our relationships, which is absolutely true, in lockstep with that is the notion that there are more things that we're going to notice and more potential threats that can come online at a given time. So, I mean, in terms of practical advice, I think it's critical that couples have a diverse repertoire of things that they can do and draw on their past experiences and learn from them in ways that they can build mutually satisfying so that, you know, so both partners are achieving satisfaction in how they're dealing with these threats. By the same token, they need to spend time thinking about their relationships. They need to spend time communicating deeply. And some of the other tips that Eli provided in terms of what they're asking of each other.
Does your research provide any insights about maybe how couples should argue or resolve disagreement? Just one example comes to mind from my own life, and that if I'm having a disagreement with somebody and their model is if things get too heated, you walk out of the room and let people cool down. And where I'm concerned, it's like that's the absolute worst thing you could do is walk out when I'm expressing something or we're in the middle of something until we've got it resolved. Are there strategies for couples to resolve those threats as they approach? Maybe they've got different models of what an argument should look like and act like and sound like.
Right, absolutely. And I admittedly, I'm stepping slightly outside the bounds of what I typically look at, but it's mm-hmm. fairly well documented that there are absolutely constructive ways to argue and engage in conflict and destructive ones. And what's also critical is that couples understand each other's strategy. So as you just mentioned, if your strategy is to avoid and to leave the room, and that's absolutely at odds with the way your partner handles things, that's not going to result in a particularly successful conflict resolution. But in general, it's not about having the conflicts because we all have them. It's about how they're managed and if they're managed in a mutually agreeable and constructive manner.
And Eli, would some of these strategies fit into what you call your love hacks?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think so. So love hacks are strategies that you can use when you aren't ready to sacrifice your expectations for the marriage. You're not ready to say, look, the marriage is never going to be able to fulfill me in these certain ways. But, you know, there are two kids at home and things are crazy at work and you just don't have the time to engage in exciting activities with your spouse regularly right now, or you don't have the emotional wherewithal to do that. Are there quick and dirty procedures that you can use to keep things going pretty strong while you're trying to bide your time to get to the point where you can invest more in the relationship? And the scholarship, the research on this has gotten good. And in the book, I talk about eight different strategies that are all research supported that we can use, where the goal is not really to improve the relationship in some major way, but to try to look at things in the relationship in a way that's more generous and generally makes us happier in the relationship.
Can you give us a few?
The key of these, yeah, I'll give you an example. I mean, the key of the love hacks is they don't take much time and they don't even have to involve your partner. One of the ones that I like is one that we actually developed here at Northwestern, where we have people think about conflict in a new way. Specifically, we ran a study where we recruited 120 married couples, and we followed them over time and assessed their relationship satisfaction. And we assigned half of them to think about conflict in a relationship from the perspective of a neutral third party who wants the best for everybody. And it turns out that people who had done that, who had written for a total of 21 minutes over the course of the year trying to think about conflicts from this neutral third-party perspective, were in fact happier in the relationship and indeed enjoyed a little bit of elevated romantic attraction or sexual desire for their partner too. And again, there's a whole series of them in the book that people can look at, but they're all quick and dirty sorts of procedures that just let us look at things and experience the relationship in a way that's more generous and tends to make both people more happy.
Eli Finkel, your book is The All or Nothing Marriage, How the Best Marriages Work. You're a professor of psychology at Northwestern University. And Brian Ogalski, he is the relationship expert and associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Yvonne Greer, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Over the past 50 years, millions of children across the U.S. from low-income families have been able to get access to early childhood education, nutrition, health and social services through a program called Head Start. And here in Illinois, agencies across the state have recently received word that they'll receive millions of dollars in federal funding to continue to provide these services to their communities. We thought we'd use this as an opportunity to learn more about Head Start, what it is, the impact we're seeing on families and on children here in Illinois. We're joined now by Sharon Frame. She's the director of Head Start programs at the Ember River Basin Agency in Greenup, about 75 miles south of Champaign. Sharon, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Yvonne.
So set the stage for us, if you will. For those not familiar with the program Head Start, can you help us understand what it's all about?
Sure. Head Start was started in 1965 as part of the War on Poverty. It was started by President Kennedy and finished up by President Lyndon Johnson. As of today, it's the only program out of the War on Poverty that is still surviving. The thought at that time was that there should be a program for a preschool for children from low-income families, because there were a lot of children from that demographic who were not receiving anything and went to kindergarten very ill prepared. So it was designed as a preschool program for children from low income families, and has a huge parent involvement component. The parent involvement component was designed into this program. So family engagement is a very vital part of the program. We provide comprehensive services, so we're talking health services, crisis intervention for families, social services. We provide medical, academic, nutrition. We feed the children breakfast, lunch, and dinner, a snack, if they are in a full-day program. So we meet at least, for any child, we meet at least two of the minimum daily requirement meals for those children. This was a huge step forward for these families. And the fact that Head Start provides comprehensive services, and it's not just a babysitting service, and it is not just an academic service, was at that time huge, and it still is today. This really sets Head Start apart from other pre-K programs that anyone might find in a school system, a school district, or a typical daycare setting.
Now, you mentioned at its onset that Head Start was designed to help those kids who were coming to kindergarten unprepared. Talk to me about this achievement gap, if you will, the difference in test scores between minority and low-income students and those peers who come from more affluent homes.
Well, they find that reading, of course, is a huge, huge part of this, because children who come from more affluent homes, in the main, have access to libraries. They have access to books. They have access to, in this day and age, they have access to computer systems and internet and technology devices that, in many cases, low-income children don't have access to. In that day, we were talking about a huge population that were basically living in substandard housing. It was a struggle just to survive for food, clothing, and shelter. And academics became less important because you were just trying to get by and survive. So as far as what we see in the classrooms, kindergarten teachers now, and they have told us this, and I think they would say it again, that they can tell children that come from the Head Start program, because they are children who are used to being in a group. They're used to sharing. They're used to being accountable to a teacher. And they are finding that test scores in all sorts of areas, from literacy to numeracy to language development, to social emotional stability and wellness, that the scores are higher for those children when they come in than they are for children who go to kindergarten without any sort of a head start, whether it's our program or whether it's another pre-K program.
So these things definitely tell you that you are using Head Start to narrow that achievement gap.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the skills that they attain carry them well through the first few years of elementary school. It's some of the later things, Yvonne, that really show up. Like, for example, children who have attended Head Start typically have a lower teenage pregnancy rate. They have a higher high school graduation rate. They have a higher rate of children who leave high school and go on to college. They have a lower crime rate. They have a lower rate of children, young adults, teens who end up in jail, even for a one-night stay. So it often, with Head Start programming, it is often the later skills and later social-emotional aspects of life that show an increase in those children who have been to the Head Start program.
And just for clarification's sake, what's the criteria for comparison? So these kids have improved success rates versus kids who were in their same socioeconomic situation that didn't go to Head Start, or versus any other child that has gone to school with them after kindergarten?
Studies have been done on both of those areas, Yvonne. And when it's compared to children who are in the same socioeconomic area, population, demographic, those who go to Head Start and those who don't, the statistics are they're pretty staggering as far as the rate of improvement, the rate of progress, the rate of development. When you look at children who have gone to any pre-K program, and how they compare to a child who has not attended any, that those rates are generally pretty much the same for Head Start and other pre-K programs. The thing that you would find that is very different is how welcome and engaged the families feel, and what kind of progress the families show in areas such as continuing education, parenting skills, homeless populations moving into housing. Those are some of the areas where you find a greater disparity between families who have gone to Head Start and families that have gone to a regular pre-K program.
In what ways do you feel like the Head Start program does work to involve the parents, and why is it so important to the children's success?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think it shows if parents are involved, it shows their children that education is important, and that this is an important enough thing for the parents to be involved and to volunteer. I think it also, as far as the parents, it shows a bit of power, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean it's empowering. That's what I mean to say. Mm-hmm. It's an empowering aspect of their life for them to be invited and welcome into a Head Start center, and to be asked or invited to actually participate with the children and not stand by as an observer or just, you know, standing by and watching what's happening in the classroom. When parents come into our classroom, we involve them as much as they want to be. If they want to just come and have lunch with the children, they are welcome. If they want to come and spend the whole day, ride the bus in with their children, spend the whole day, read stories to the other children, do puzzles with the other children, play games with them, they go outside and they engage them on the playground. We see parents who are in all phases of involvement in the Head Start program. We have parent groups in every one of our centers, and this is a nationwide thing. The parents are part of a parent group. They have monthly meetings. They make decisions about what's happening on the local level. So they are helping the teacher make decisions about what are we going to do as far as a field trip. Who do we want? Do we want to have a speaker come and talk to the parents about whatever, about getting a library card, about domestic violence, about substance abuse? at the parent meetings. We will have speakers come in and talk to the parents there. This is something that parents would have to be going out and finding their own if they were not in the Head Start program.
You serve these families in 9 different counties throughout southern Illinois.
Yes, I know.
A lot of times when we talk about government funding, we think about big city areas, but this is Clark,
yes.
Coles, Douglas, Lawrence County. What is your area like?
Our area is very rural. You would find in our area that our centers are very far apart from each other. If you went to the city of Chicago, for example, you would find Head Start centers, Head Start programs that maybe have 1,000 children. They're all housed in one building. So if I, as a program director, want to go out and monitor my staff, or want to just visit with the children, or want to meet the parents of a certain center, if mm-hmm. I wanted to do that in Chicago, all I'd have to do is go into the building. One building. If I want to do it here, it takes more than a day to make an entire circle of our 9 counties and visit every Head Start center. It takes an entire day plus to go in, say hi to people, take your coat off, say hi to the staff, spend a little bit of time with the children, and get back, and then get back to the office. It takes about a day and a half. So very rural, Yvonne. We do not have, our unemployment rates are high. Our poverty rates they're in line with the state poverty rates. We have not a lot of factories, and in fact, we have a huge one that's closing in Mattoon right now that employed probably 200 people, and it's now closed down. It just is closing in December. So we have a lot of people who are seeking help, seeking employment. We have a lot of farm country here. And again, great distances between our centers and in mm-hmm. our community, so our children are bused in. We provide transportation for the children to be able to come to Head Start.
So what impact are you seeing at your Head Start program, since you have the ability to get out? I know it takes a full day to get out and see everybody. But what do you yes. hear from the children? What do you hear from the families as far as the impact Head Start is having on their lives?
We do a parent questionnaire every year. And they are extremely positive. Parents will say, thank you for getting my child ready for kindergarten. Parents will say, thank you for taking care of the dental services for my child. Yvonne, we have children who come into our program with literally cavities in every one of their teeth. And in our area here, dental care and medical care, especially for children that are between the ages of 3 and 5, it's just some dentists simply will not see a population that young. There are a great many providers that don't take the medical card, and a great many of our parents use the medical card for their insurance. We have parents who tell us, thank you for helping me get into college. Thank you for helping me get my GED. Thank you for involving me in some decision making, because now I feel like I can go out into my community and help make a difference in my community. We do three times a year, Yvonne, we do assessments on the children, and we take a baseline in September and October, and then our second checkpoint is in February, our third checkpoint is in May, and we see huge, huge growth between those three sections of our assessment. We see major growth. I mean, we're talking about 50% growth in skills such as literacy, social, emotional, cognitive skills.
So with that level of success, I would imagine that you're just that much more excited that you recently received $1.8 million in federal funding from the Department of Health and Human Services.
Extremely so. Yes.
So what do you hope our listeners will understand about the need for programs like Head Start in communities like yours as we close?
Well, I just want people to know that you know, if a Head Start program is available in your community and you are eligible for it, go out and fill out an application and take advantage of this. This is a program that is a blessing and a benefit for not only for the children but also for the families. We hope with the infusion of this money, these monies, that we will be able to continue our services in a strong, strong way. And the thing that I have loved about Head Start for my whole involvement with it, and I started out as a parent in the program, so I've been there. I've seen Head Start from every angle. The thing, one of the things that I loved the most was the caring and the love that was shown to my children, and the fact that I was strongly involved and invited to be involved as a parent. That's just a huge aspect of the Head Start program. We have parents that are making decisions about their children's education in this program, and that you will not see in the public school setting.
Well, we will certainly make sure that we tweet out more information for families that are interested in learning more about Head Start and have it available also on our website, 21stshow.org. Sharon Frame, you come at this from both sides as someone who used the program and as someone who now helps administer the program. We thank you very much for your information as the director of the Head Start program in Ember River Basin Agency in Greenup, about 75 miles south of Champaign. Thank you so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you, Yvonne. I appreciate it.
That's all we have time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is on our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Yvonne Greer, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.